Welcome to the Beginner Photography Podcast. Today, we are learning about the biggest advancements in American photography history. So let's get into it.
Welcome to the Beginner Photography Podcast, a weekly podcast for those who believe that moments matter most and that a beautiful photo is more than just a sum of its settings. A show for those who want to do more with the gear they have to take better photos today. And now, your host, Raymond Hatfield.
Welcome back to this episode of the podcast. As always, I'm your host, Raymond Hatfield, and a wedding photographer right here in Indianapolis. And today we got something really fun. We are going to be looking at the history of photography and how we got here. But first, I want to give a quick shout out to our own Lori Smith for leaving the podcast a 5-star iTunes review. Lori says, "I'm a longtime listener. I would not classify myself as a beginner anymore. However, this podcast is very informative. I learn so much each week. There's a good variety of guests and something for everyone. If you haven't joined the Facebook group yet, you're missing out on a great community. Thank you, Raymond, for all that you do." No, Lori, thank you. Thank you so much for leaving the show a review. Like she said, Lori's been listening to the podcast for quite some time, and it's just been really great to interact with her and everyone else in the Facebook group. Now, if you're not already a part of the Facebook group, what are you waiting for? Search for the group on Facebook by just searching Beginner Photography Podcast, and it'll show up. And if you are looking for a quick and easy way to support the show, be like Lori and leave the podcast a review in your favorite podcast player. Reviews are an extremely important part of the podcast, and I love reading each and every one. And speaking of the Facebook group, if you are in the Facebook group, you probably saw that a few weeks ago, I posted a photo of me reading a new book called Good Pictures, A History of American Photography. Now, after making it just a few pages into the book, I knew that I had to get the author Kim Beale on the podcast to talk about some of the major milestones of the past that got us to where we are today. So it's a really interesting look. Kim is actually an art history lecturer at Stanford University. And as you'll be able to tell, she's not only, you know, put in the proper research, but she makes it really fun and pretty easy to digest. So with that, let's go ahead and get on into this interview with Kim Beale. I know that today you teach art history at Stanford, but before you got here, when did your love of photography start?
It started really when I was just 10 or 12 years old. My parents gave me a 35 millimeter camera, and I loved running film through it. So especially taking portraits of my family and my friends. And I'm, you know, grateful that my sister was a willing subject. But it was, yeah, I've loved photography ever since then.
So with that first camera, was that like a full manual camera? Was it like a point and shoot? Do you remember what it was?
Yeah, I think it was a Nikon FM. And it's still like one of my favorite cameras to use. It just feels like the manual focus really allows you to lock right in on it. And I love the feeling of the world coming into focus. So you can see it. You can really see it through the manual lenses. But after that, I went to undergrad for comparative literature at Brown. And at the same time, I was really lucky to get to take some photo courses at the Rhode Island School of Design. So that's where my, you know, hobby in photography, well, it was still a hobby then, but at least then I got to have some formal training.
Right. So when you first had the Nikon FM and you were first given it as a child, essentially, this is like a full manual camera. This is not something that you just point and shoot, essentially. What were some of the challenges that you faced when it came to trying to expose an image on film?
Well, the camera store that sold these cameras used actually had a training class that my dad took me to. And I remember it was in an old hotel conference room, and it was me and a bunch of probably like middle-aged men and my dad. And they taught us a lot about the controls. And so right away, I mean, I knew about aperture and f-stops, but I don't know if I knew exactly how they worked. So one of the things was probably trying to recreate the effects that I saw in pictures, you know, in handbooks, And I remember being sort of confused about how you get that nice blurry background and sometimes achieving it and then sometimes not. But of course, I wasn't, you know, taking a record of all my, I didn't have a shot list, so I didn't know what my aperture was. But I think that was probably the thing I was after originally.
Getting that out of focus background?
Yeah, isn't that funny?
Yeah, still today, that's like the number one thing requested by you know, by new photographers is how do I get my backgrounds to get out of focus and look beautiful?
Yeah,
that's too funny. So how did you, were you using, taking any sort of film notes or anything like that to do any sort of reflection after you got your images back?
No, I didn't do any of that until my classes at RISD, and that really started in the darkroom. Especially with making prints. So I started to understand like how you can change time and aperture to change the quality of the print. And then you work backwards. And I started doing that to achieve a better negative that's easier to print.
Oh, okay. I see. Do you remember maybe a time where you had some sort of aha moment where everything just kind of sort of came together, and going forward from that point, the technical side of photography just seemed to make more sense to you?
Wouldn't that be lovely?
Yes.
You know what? I don't think I have an aha moment. I think I'm still very much an amateur photographer, even if I'm a professional observer of photography. So maybe my aha moments come a little bit more when I can see other photographers using these techniques in their work. So that doesn't come probably until grad school.
Okay, I see. So tell me more about the kind of that transition for you, because you said that you went to school for, or I'm sorry if I got this wrong, but you said that you went to grad school for literature. Is that correct?
I went to undergrad for literature. Yeah, and surprisingly, I didn't take any art history courses. I just took my photo practice classes, which were, you know, incredibly rich and full of photographic examples. I was lucky to study with Stephen Smith, who's a wonderful photographer and photo bookmaker. But then I went on and did like a postgraduate degree in photojournalism at Brooks in California. And while I was doing that is when I started sort of drifting away from making my own pictures and becoming more interested in the history of photography. And so I started interning at a museum in Santa Barbara. And so that's the transition from undergrad making pictures to grad school studying the history of photography.
Why do you think it was that you were so captivated by the history of art and photography? Are you ready to transform your love for photography into profit? Imagine capturing beautiful moments while bringing in a little extra money for your family each month. Sound too good to be true? With CloudSpot, it's not just a dream. Designed by photographers for photographers, CloudSpot simplifies your business. Effortlessly organize shoots, send professional contracts, questionnaires, invoices, and enjoy faster payment payouts with the lowest fees in the industry, including PayPal. Forget lost emails and messy spreadsheets. CloudSpot offers a streamlined workflow, letting you focus on the moment. And here is the clincher. Grab your free CloudSpot account at deliverphotos.com, and you'll get access to my personal wedding and portrait contracts and questionnaires. So don't let uncertainty hold you back. Embrace the future of photography business management with CloudSpot Studio. Sign up at deliverphotos.com today and transform your passion into profit.
Yeah, it took me a little while to come to that, but I think I love that it encompasses so many different histories. It's not just a history of a few, you know, battles or key technological innovations. It's really about how people interact with the medium, but also about how people interact with the world. So it's a really broad history and deep. You get to experience different people's lives. So it's a medium for understanding people and for understanding how they look at the world and each other.
Oh, I love that. That is such a good. Oh, that's a good quote. I gotta tell Jim to write that down for me. So in your new book here that we're talking about, Good Pictures, which is essentially it's the history of American photography. Is that an accurate representation or depiction?
Yes. Yep. I had to draw the line somewhere, so I focused on pictures made in the U.S.
Perfect. So there is a little blurb on the back of the book that says that the rules for good pictures are always shifting. Now, I'm assuming that we're talking about the technical standpoint. Is that correct?
Yeah, they could be technical rules, but they're also rules for content, like what things are you allowed to take pictures of? And as Pierre Bourdieu would say, like what is photographable? So it's a rule for content, but it could also be composition or lighting. So they're, you know, in photography, the technical rules kind of overlap with the aesthetic rules.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So then let's talk a little bit more kind of about where this book came about and why, or I take that back. Let's talk a little bit more about how you saw the rules for good pictures shifting and what kind of some of the main overall arching themes have been since the beginning of photography.
Yeah, it's interesting because, you know, as I was just saying, I think I felt those rules and I didn't question them for much of my experience in making pictures. So I wanted to recreate that blurry background. I wanted to make pictures like the pictures that I saw. And then, you know, when you start to study fine art, the thing that's prized is originality. So somebody who does something different than what just following the rules. So I was already aware of that division between like taking pictures of sunsets and somehow making something into a new kind of art. But I think it was really the rise of the iPhone that started pointing out the changes in the rules, because so many more people were talking about what makes a good picture around 2010. And I remember specifically that there's a lot of anxiety about how to take a selfie. Like, how do you take a good selfie? I remember people telling me, you know, it has to be from a high angle. And specifically, I had a friend who like demonstrated this thing, you know, you put your tongue to the roof of your mouth and you get better cheekbones. And I just started wondering about all these rules. Like, is this really the best or the only way to take a picture? And so sure enough, when I started looking into the history, like just looking through Life magazine or old how-to guidebooks, I saw that the high angle wasn't the only style, that low angle pictures were really popular in the late 1930s and the early 1940s. So you got these like really triumphant figures framed against a blue sky, and people thought they looked heroic. And that was the only angle to take a good portrait from. So that's when I started questioning the rules. And then I think your second part of that question was about what kind of general trends and rules have I seen?
Yes. Yeah. Good memory.
So I think probably composition is one of the areas that seems most dogmatic. We've got the rule of thirds, you know, which interestingly was invented not by a photographer, but by Joshua Reynolds, the first president of the Royal Academy in London. So he was teaching painters how to organize their compositions. But I think photographers have really picked up on that rule and they take it pretty seriously. So I'd say, yeah, compositional rules. And they're not always the same, but the rule of thirds, I'd say, is probably the most dominant rule that I've seen.
Right. It's pretty easy to understand. You know, you can explain to a child the tic-tac-toe board, you know, overlay of a photo and try to, you know, put your subject within those intersecting lines, where it's harder to do something like, you know, the golden rule or something like that. Mm-hmm. To fully understand. But let's talk a little bit more about that, you know, really the early days of photography. And it was really, photography was kind of scoffed at, wasn't it? It was, can you talk about the relationship between photography and painters?
Oh, yeah, it was, you're right. It was considered a challenge to the medium of painting originally, mostly because and you're saying it was scoffed at, and that's because it wasn't considered imaginative, that it was simply technical, and that the image was recorded by this machine, and it didn't come out of any kind of learning or imagination on the part of the artist. And I'd say that that way of thinking about photography was present all the way through the 19th century. And there were certainly some people who rejected it and tried to prove it wrong, but it was pretty widely agreed that a true artist had to be someone who makes an image from their own hand. And then, let's see, where should we go from there?
Yeah, I was just thinking of Bob Ross there and all those years when I was younger watching him paint landscapes. And I wonder what Bob Ross would think about landscape photography. But yeah, I mean, it's really interesting when it comes to photography and how it was just looked at as just so technical and not imaginative. That is crazy, because now, you know, as we know today, at least as we know photography today, it can be a very creative pursuit and very imaginative, I suppose. So just interesting how times change like that. But mm-hmm. I want to focus on your book here, because in the book you showcase 50 different techniques that really, you know, made some of the biggest advancements in photography. And I want to talk about just a few here today. And the first one, which honestly, when I was reading the book, like, I had to stop and think about it for a second. The first one that I want to talk about is the vignette. Now, today, I mean, just a simple slider in Lightroom can give you a beautiful vignette with no effort and a lot of control. But originally, I mean, this is a physical recording onto the film of a technique, I guess. So can you talk a bit about what a vignette is, where it came from, and then just the reaction to this brand new photographic technique?
Yeah. So I think one of the interesting things about where these techniques come from is sometimes they start out as accidents or failures within the technical process. So the vignette is actually the result of using a lens that's too small to illuminate the full image area. So I'm not saying negative, because these weren't film negatives that were being used. Sometimes it was a metal plate or eventually a glass negative. But if you use a lens that doesn't allow enough light into your camera, you get these darkened corners, because of course all images are round. They come in the lens, and some of it is a round lens and some of it's cropped off at the corners. So originally, if people saw an image that was darkened at the corner, it was considered a kind of failure. But it was later picked up as a way to make photographs look more artistic, to make them seem more like paintings or drawings. And so a couple different techniques were developed to create the vignetting effect, even when you're using an appropriately sized lens. So one of the ways to do that would be to create a little frame that you could hold in front of the lens, and you would move it around to make those softened edges. And that would make your picture look a little bit more like a hand-drawn portrait bust, which was also popular at the time. So earlier you were talking about the way that photography was scoffed at by painters. And this was a response on the part of the photographic establishment to make the medium seem more like the established painting trends.
That's so crazy. I love it. Just a way for photographers to say, to kind of legitimize what it is that they're doing, because now they are using something with their imagination, and they're being able to create something. But just to be clear, when you said we're making these frames, or photographers were making these frames and then kind of moving it around in front of the lens, they were only able to do this because they had extremely long exposure times, correct?
Yeah, that's a great point. So an exposure time of 30 seconds to a minute was not uncommon, especially if you're working indoors, and especially if you're working during the winter when the light is not as powerful. So you have enough time to put this little frame in front of the lens, move it around, and get an exposure that looks more like a portrait painting than a photo.
And today, you know, it's one of those rules that, like, you don't want to go under like 1/60th of a second, like such a small fraction of a second. And here we are I mean, I don't know what the math is, but, you know, 30 full seconds compared to a 60th of a second is just insane to see how far we've come in photography. So this is why, you know, I think when I was reading it, thinking about the photography, the history of photography and kind of where it came from are things that I never really had an interest in, I suppose. I just knew how, like today, like I know how to take a photo. I know that my couples like my photos, and that's about it. But I think understanding where that vignette came from and the physical moving of a frame in front of the lens to be able to create something like this is so, you know, almost barbaric. But now it's something that I don't take for granted, I suppose, just that one little slider there in Lightroom. Mm-hmm. But something that isn't, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, I love that Lightroom and Photoshop have preserved those historic terms. Mm-hmm. So a lot of the tools or the icons that we see in digital processing actually come from the analog or wet darkroom. So like dodging and burning. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Can you explain what those two things are for those who are unaware?
Sure. So even though you can take a photo in, you know, 1/60th of a second, often you want to develop a print in the darkroom using a longer period of time so that you have time to get in there and manually manipulate the light. So if you have an area of an image that's your negative is too thin, it allows too much light through too quickly onto the developing paper, you can put your hand in and kind of block the light while you allow the rest of the image to be exposed. So you see the fist is the icon for dodging, I believe, in Photoshop and Lightroom. Mm-hmm. So that's a way of blocking the light from this one area.
Physically with your hand, just no light right there, and that's gonna change the look of my image. That's
right.
That's wild. That's something that you don't get, you know, today in digital photography. But you're right; it is cool that it was preserved, I suppose. Do you think that that's just simply to make the transition easier from the switch from film to digital?
Yeah, I think it was actually when I before I went back to grad school, and even when I was studying photojournalism, it was the beginning of the digital revolution, and people were really reluctant. I mean, in museums and established photographers, I mean, there were definitely ways in which early digital work fell short of the qualities of analog photography. There wasn't as much detail, the colors weren't what we were expecting. And so I think that these tools and the carryover of certain terms, you're absolutely right, we're meant to make the transition easier.
I wonder what's going to be next, because literally yesterday, my son, he's in second grade, but he's doing all of his learning virtual this year. And in one of his little online tutorials, it showed him how to save a document, and it's just a picture of a floppy disk. And he literally asked me, he said, you know, what is that? He's like, I know what the laptop is right there. I know what, you know, the headphones are, but what is that thing? And I had to explain, you know, what a floppy disk is. And obviously that's just some sort of carryover to make it easier during that transition. But surely in the future, something's going to have to be different or changed. And it's going to be interesting to see what those things are.
Yeah,
but going back to photography, I want to talk now again about, let's go back to the 1800s, in the 1860s, when the world was just taken by storm, when photographers started using foreground interest in their photos. This was a concept that had never been, you know, done before. So what were we doing before with photography that made foreground just so fascinating? Hey, Raymond here, and I know that diving into the world of editing can feel like navigating a maze, especially if you're just starting out. So that's why I created our exclusive collection of 52 Lightroom presets, absolutely free. While presets can dramatically enhance your photos, they're not a one-click solution. They're a starting point for your creativity and an opportunity to learn and grow in your editing skills. These presets work seamlessly with all versions of Lightroom, whether you're on a computer or using Lightroom Mobile. And they're designed to simplify your editing process, adding that professional touch to your photos while giving you the flexibility to fine-tune them to your taste. So if you're ready to take your photos to the next level, head over to freephotographypresets.com right now and get editing today.
I think in that chapter, I describe the fact that these photo editors of the industry publications were really frustrated with the quality of American landscape photographs. And I think it wasn't that they were avoiding foreground interest, but that they were focusing on other things. So they were concentrating on getting a perfect exposure and, you know, avoiding the darkening of the corners. And so there were so many ways in which photographs could be failures at this point. You know, they could be slightly out of focus. Your developing times could be wrong. Things could move in the frame. And so they were so concentrated on all these other issues that composition was not at the forefront of their minds. And I think there's a second reason for that too. And that's that people who picked up photography in the 1840s, 50s, and 60s, that's really just the first three decades of its life as a publicly accessible medium. Those people were not artists for the most part. I mean, they were like dentists or tinkers. They were people who would travel around and fix your pots and pans from one village to another. They were sometimes, you know, experimenters, scientists, entrepreneurs, but not very many of them started out as landscape painters. And so people really hadn't had a lot of exposure to what foreground interest is and what use it would even have in a picture. So that this is like the development of a kind of aesthetic training that finally comes to photography.
I see. Interesting. So it wasn't, I always, I guess, just assumed that some of the first photographers were maybe failed painters or even experienced painters who, just couldn't be out in nature long enough to capture the painting. So it was almost like a form of documentation so that they could go back and possibly replicate it later. But hearing this, that really changes things, you know, that it's that it was really just those interested kind of in trying something new, and then the art came after the fact. Is that pretty fair to say?
Yeah, I think that's right. And there were certainly technical limitations in the beginning too that made it impossible to take pictures outside. So landscape photography was really only becoming possible at this time, again, because of the long exposure times, but also because of the unwieldiness of the camera. It's this giant wooden box that has to be on a tripod, again, a giant wooden tripod. You have glass or metal plates, some which have to be prepared in the field. So you have to pour your light sensitive chemicals over the plate while you're out in the field. So that means you have to bring multiple chemicals in their glass bottles in a tent, a portable dark room. And then you have to put the sticky plate inside your camera while you're out there. So it's not something that a painter would use to save him any effort. It's like a big undertaking.
So when did that change? When did landscape photography become more predominant? Was it after we moved away from glass and metal plates?
The glass and metal plates were still used throughout the 1880s. And I'd say, yes, there were a lot more landscape photographers working in the 1860s, as you mentioned. But in the early 1880s, we have the production of dry plates. So those were pre-prepared plates that you could buy from a manufacturer. And I think that's when people were, amateurs were more able to take their cameras out into the field.
I see. So this brings me to my next question, which is just simply that, well, this part isn't the question, but we can't talk about the history of photography and not talk about one of the biggest camera manufacturers or photographic manufacturers, which is just Kodak. So can you talk about maybe what is it that Kodak did that made such a big impact in the photography community and even the world?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, this is one of the big things about the way we describe photography in history classes that I think needs to be clarified. And that's that cameras originally and the whole process of photography was really cumbersome and really involved a lot of technical and chemical savvy and a place to purchase these chemicals and dispose of them. And so Kodak's major innovation was their development of the photo finishing process. So you would buy your camera loaded with film from Kodak, and then you could send that whole thing back to Kodak and they would process, they would develop the film and make the prints for you. So before that, you had to do all that work and be set up to do all that work at home on your own. And so that's the major innovation. So the Kodak number one camera was invented in 1888. And that, I think, marks the beginning of photography becoming much more readily accessible and becoming really a democratic medium the way it's described today.
Oh, okay. But there was actually quite a bit of pushback against Kodak as well from other established photographers. Is that correct?
Yeah. So I think photographers like Alfred Stieglitz at the turn of the century, they thought that the pictures that were being made by Kodak photographers, these amateurs, were not art. And they were concerned that they were dragging down the possibility of the medium's success. So that's this period where the photographers start kind of going back to the more labor-intensive processes and rejecting the ease of the photo finishing industry. So if anybody is frustrated with the market expanding so quickly, it would be those folks who were arguing for photography to become like a kind of elite and artistic medium.
Which sounds eerily similar to when the transition to digital was made with the argument from film photographers, right?
Yeah, you are absolutely right.
So even 120 some odd years before the invention of digital photography, photographers were still arguing about the exact same thing. So this is good to know. This is good to know.
That's right. Just wait. It'll get better.
It always gets better. It's just, I don't know. People are so scared of change, I suppose. I guess that's it. Hey, we will get right back into my interview with Kim Beal. But first, I wanted to share a word about this week's podcast sponsor, The Contract Vault. Now, a few weeks ago, I asked those of you in the Beginner Photography Podcast Facebook group, just how much do you think it would cost to hire a lawyer to create all of the contracts that you would need as a photographer? So Brett said $2,000 at the very least. Dylan said $5,000 to $10,000. Susan and Malgrazada said $3,000. The point here is that we know that contracts are important, but when we're just getting started, that hefty price tag can stop you from getting the legal protection that you already know that you need. And that is why I'm so excited to have found this week's sponsor, The Contract Vault. The Contract Vault provides all access to reliable contract templates specific to the photography industry. Now, you're probably not an attorney. You probably didn't go to law school. But regardless, whether you've made $100 with your camera or $100,000 with your camera, you are still responsible for the legal stuff. So the Contract Vault arms you with all the legal knowledge in order to steer clear of potential lawsuits. That's great. And on top of the contracts, you get access to the members-only Facebook group where Andrea Sager, the founder, goes live every single month to teach you about the legal stuff that can help you better protect your growing photography business. So sign up now at thecontractvault.com and use code BPP, that's BPP for Beginner Photography Podcast, to get 20% off of your first month and get your hands on the contract templates and the legal knowledge you need for your growing business. Again, promo code BPP for 20% off your first month at thecontractvault.com. Now, let's talk a little bit about night photography, because today, when it comes to night photography, I have no concerns, you know, going out and shooting at night, you know, doing it at weddings and even in a paid profession, you know. But before the 1890s, this idea, it wasn't even possible, right? So what was it that made it possible? And why did photographers even want to shoot at night at that point?
Yeah, this was really fascinating to me, too. Night photography becomes a genre around the 1880s, 90s, late 1890s, when photographers bring their cameras out into the street, they set them up on tripods and let them go for a long time. So yes, you have these dry plates that I was just talking about. They're much more light sensitive, but you're still looking at an exposure of 30 minutes or more. And one of the my favorite quotes that I found in these how-to books describes a photographer who would measure his exposure by the number of times he had to refill his pipe.
That's so ridiculous.
Oh, I know. But it also gives you a good sense probably of how long that would take.
Yeah, if it's multiple times, yeah, that's not a very quick endeavor for sure.
Right.
So what were some of the challenges, I guess, that prevented us from shooting at night before? Was it just simply that the dry plates were more sensitive to light?
Yeah, initially, like, you need to have a plate that's sensitive to light to some degree in order to record anything. And then the second development that came about is interesting, because at first it's embraced and then it's rejected. And that's the creation of these anti-halation plates. Mm. So halation is this kind of halo effect that you get around a light that's shining directly into the lens. So it's extra bright around the center of this overexposed light. So photographers were cautioned initially by these how-to guides to cover up the light. So you get lots of pictures where there's like a street light, but it's hiding behind a tree, or there's a person, you know, posed perfectly to block the light. So you get a shot, a silhouette, and that light glowing behind them. But then when the anti-halation plates were invented, photographers started to think, well, actually, these don't look like night photographs. It doesn't look like my experience of seeing at night. And so people started to kind of backtrack and add back in some of that halation to give you a more kind of pictorial effect, the sense of being out at night and seeing the atmosphere carry the light away from whatever light source you're looking at.
Oh, isn't that too funny? We always want what it is that we can't have, I suppose. Like, we get this new thing. My wife brings this up all the time, you know, with the growth of phones. It's like phones keep getting bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. And then I was like, you know what? I'm going to go back to like the tiny iPhone SE. It's just small. It fits in my hands. And she's like, what? Like, we spent all this time getting bigger and bigger and bigger. Now you just want to go back to the smallest one. It sounds very similar. And that must just be like a human trait, I suppose. I don't know. It's interesting. But when I was reading this this chapter on night photography, I found it really interesting. And I don't know if maybe I'm looking too deep into this or whatnot. But you mentioned that a lot of the times the photographers would rather shoot either in wet or rainy conditions or even snow, just because of the added amount of light. And when I think about being out at night in those conditions, there is typically a, I don't know if it's humidity or I don't know what it is, but there's some sort of atmosphere that is more than maybe a summer night or something like that. And I think that the halation kind of lends itself to that. Do you think that may have any part of it, or am I just crazy?
Oh, yeah. I think you're right that having some moisture in the atmosphere creates more illumination. And so instead of just an expanse of darkness, you get areas of varied gradation throughout the image. And I'm sure that they were looking for that too.
Cool. I'm glad that I'm not, you know, absolutely just bonkers on some of my thoughts here. That helps me out. So shortly after, you know, night photography, there's kind of a period between the I guess the 1900s and then into like the 1950s or so, where really we're kind of experimenting with a lot of things, but photographers are still kind of generally keeping to a lot of the same rules as before. But then during the late 50s and 60s, we see this huge swing from seeking technical perfection to now using our limitations and previously kind of standardized rules of photography and intentionally breaking them for artistic effect. Can you tell me what it was that caused this major shift? And I don't know, maybe give me an example of one such rule that became popular to break?
Yeah. Yeah, you've described that perfectly. There was always interest in reappropriating some of these failures, but I noticed that picked up in frequency in the 50s. And I think it's because we reject recent technological advancements. So we want to introduce some of those failures, but only when it's absolutely clear that we're not failing ourselves. So I think one of my favorite ones is motion blur. So blur had been a problem in photography since the 19th century, when, you know, we're talking about these really long exposure times. So you get any kind of movement in the image and it's going to result in blur. So in the late 1930s, a scientist at MIT named Harold Edgerton had pioneered this technology of making an electronic stroboscope, which is just what we think of as an electronic flash today.
Such a long name.
Yeah. So it was much better than the old magnesium flashes because it wasn't fire, and because it could be timed to the shutter on the camera electronically. So with Edgerton's discovery and his popularization of making flash photos like this in the late 1930s, that technology is adapted during World War II. And after World War II, it becomes accessible on the consumer market. So everybody has access to electronic flashes after World War II. So I think as soon as that happened, people then started reintroducing motion blur into their pictures because they got tired of seeing like pictures of kids jumping and balls being thrown in the air. And instead they started deliberately blurring their pictures, and that it wasn't just that they allowed those objects to appear blurry, but that they would pan the camera with the moving object. So you went to film school, you know this technique. If you open up or if you slow down the shutter speed and you move the camera at the same, you pan it at exactly the same speed as the moving subject, the background blurs while the moving thing stays apparently still. Mm-hmm. And so that was a really exciting technique for photographers in the 1950s and 1960s.
Yeah, I gotta say, in recent years, motion blur has become one of my favorite things as well. And I actually didn't know that little fact there about, you said it's Edgerton, correct?
Yes.
About creating this electronic flash, as this is something that today I use at every single wedding. You know, when you're shooting the reception, you know, you want that fun party atmosphere and lots of motion and people kind of, you know, people have usually had a few drinks, so it's kind of blurry and fuzzy. But when you use that flash and the duration of the flash is so short that you can freeze whatever your subject is while still getting the background, you know, with that beautiful blur and maybe some colors, there's nothing better. And now I know that I have Edgerton to thank for that exact thing that I use every single day in my wedding. So thank you for sharing that. Mm-hmm. I'm guessing Edgerton is no longer alive. Is that correct?
That's right.
Okay, but that's a shame.
There's a great selection of his images available online, though.
I'm going to check that out. I was going to send him an email, but it sounds like it's not going to go anywhere. So I'm going to have to look at those. So next, I want to talk about candids. Candids are something that many photographers today are actively sought after for. But in the beginning, you know, when I guess cameras got smaller and people were able to take candid images, they were widely criticized in the beginning. Why was the photography community so adverse to candid images?
Well, I think there was a concern about privacy, that these cameras, the small 35 millimeter cameras, were described as miniature cameras. They were also called detective cameras. And so that gives you a sense of like just what people thought these cameras were being used for. And some of them were so small, you know, they called them vest pocket cameras, but this was new to people in the like 1920s. Prior to that, you'd see a gigantic camera, it'd be sitting on a tripod, and you knew if you were going to be in a picture. So I think there's some real ambivalence about what this improvement in photography, whether this improvement in photography was in fact an improvement.
I see. So I'm sorry, go on.
Yeah. So the other reason is that like you say about Edgerton, when you take a photo with a really quick shutter speed, you kind of capture somebody in a pose that they wouldn't normally see themselves in, and that maybe even other observers wouldn't see themselves in. So I think there's something about the fact that you are unaware of the picture being made, but also that it might represent you in a way that seems untruthful to your character. That was also pretty challenging for our viewers in the early 20th century.
Wow. Being captured in a way that is untruthful to your character, when literally it's at your, at one of your truest moments, perhaps. That's,
yeah, it could be.
So it's funny because with candid photography, I mean, this is something, again, that like many photographers today are sought after for. So do you have any insight as to why you think maybe that perception changed?
Yeah. I mean, I think somebody who's looking for candids and somebody who's known for making candids is probably trying to take those most representative moments and not just any moment. And I think in the beginning, photographers who were making candid pictures were interested especially in the technical aspects of it and not necessarily the representation of the subjects. So yeah, you do have to choose between, you know, taking a picture of somebody like stuffing a fork full of cake in their mouth versus one where they're the head's thrown back and laughing and they're having a great time. there are lots of moments, and maybe we are the same people in all of them, but some of them are better representations of us than others.
Okay, that's fair. That's fair. I guess even though we are kind of true to ourselves, I suppose I've seen a few photos maybe that I've taken at weddings that are less than savory, I guess. This is probably the best
right.
way to put it.
So, right.
Well, what about the Polaroid camera? Because again, this is one of those major innovations in photography, like the Kodak camera. When I think photography, those are pretty much the two companies that really stand out, Kodak and Polaroid. But what Polaroid did was they really shook up the industry, you know, decades after Kodak did. So what was the impact that Polaroid made on the world of photography? Why did it catch so quickly?
I think people were excited about Polaroid because it was more of an experience than Kodak. So even if you're used to posing for pictures as part of your, you know, celebration, you don't get to see that picture until later. So I think Polaroid collapsed that time scale and made it possible to see the result of the picture immediately, which made posing for pictures probably that much more exciting and something that people really look forward to doing.
Yeah, that's one of the things that I know that my kids love is I know it's not a Polaroid, but when I pull out my little Fuji instant camera, they love seeing the results just moments after it comes out of the camera. And even though they can still, you know, take a picture with their phone and see it literally immediately, there's something about, I don't know if it's the tangible aspect of it today, but there's something that is still very fun and interesting about the instant film. But one thing that I found really interesting about your book, and maybe I'm, you know, a little bit embarrassed to say it, but I had no idea about the world of Polaroid manipulation. I had no idea that this was even a thing. I feel like images that I've seen of, you know, that you shared within the book, the effects that were created, I feel like I've seen those. I thought that those were just simply mistakes made by the camera, you know, maybe a light leak or something like that. But where you're going in the book is that there was a large portion of photographers who would take the Polaroids and then manipulate the images themselves. Can you talk a little bit about that and maybe why they were doing it and how big of a thing this was?
Yeah, that's really interesting. I think it was probably a short-lived trend, but it's something I remember the appeal of taking a Polaroid camera and making it into a watercolor transfer by peeling off the plastic and putting it on watercolor paper. But I hadn't realized that there were so many other methods for manipulating them. I think one of my favorites is the one that Ralph Gibson describes, that you can put a Polaroid in a toaster or in the or in the freezer. So there's all of these ways of kind of breaking down this perfect, supposedly perfect print that's supposed to be ejected from the Polaroid. But this is, again, one of those moments where the technology suddenly promises something new and perfect. And photographers say, wait a minute, but we don't want it that way. We're going to try to make it, we're going to take some of that control back, and we're going to do something to the surface of the print. And so it's, in that way, it's not unlike motion blur or even vignetting, because it's almost it's an intentional step backwards for aesthetic effect.
An intentional step backwards for aesthetic effect. It seems kind of like an overarching theme of the growth of photography. Now that you say that, I mean you're right. Why are we as photographers taking these quote unquote seemingly perfect things and messing with them? Why do you think that is?
I think it's, again, a need to have some imaginative or creative intervention. So maybe it's still a little bit of a fear over, you know, how creative is this mechanical art. But it's also, I mean, especially with iPhones and other digital photography today, so much of what makes a good picture is actually built into the camera, and you don't really have a choice. And I think that this is a place where you can exert some control and have some creative license. And so, I mean, it's really only an accident or a failure if we call it that. Otherwise, you know, we could describe it as it's another tool. But what makes it wrong or right is only just a definition.
Wow. I've never thought of photography that way. But it kind of lifts the weight off of my shoulders, I guess. There's been many a times where I've tried something new and, you know, maybe it didn't turn out right the first time or the first 10 times, you know. But I see maybe years later somebody else doing it and then just doing a fantastic job at it. And that that does help. One thing I wanted to say, though, about the whole Polaroid thing is after I read that little chapter about Polaroid manipulation, I actually had to Google it because I was so unaware of what exactly was being manipulated and how it was being manipulated, I suppose. And there I found a video from a man named Mike Dukas, who I suppose, at least according to the video, was the Polaroid chief. He wasn't the chief technical officer, but he was like the chief like imaginative officer or something like that, like some made up title. And he made a series of videos in the 90s of how to manipulate Polaroids, where he was taking like 8x10 Polaroids and just like putting them on shirts. How he would make shirts. And I was shocked by this. And I'm gonna put a video in the show notes of this episode for anybody to check out. But it's worth it just to see the awesome 90s fashion of like all white. I mean, and the camera's at like a 20-degree like angle, just all crooked. It was fascinating to watch. And it honestly made me sad that a lot of these instant films aren't being produced today, because I got really excited about this creative aspect of photography. And now, you know, I suppose the type of instant film that we have today isn't something called zero time or time zero film, and that it can't be done in the same way. So this is just something that now lives in the past and can't be done again. So this is why, you know, the art history is so important, because I will say that even though I can't do this exact thing, learning about this, you know, in your book here gave me creative ideas that I can do, even though it's not the same, maybe on my iPad, maybe in, you know, Procreate. Maybe I bring a photo into Procreate and I do something unique with it. And that got me really excited about photography again. So I thank you for that.
Oh, good. I'm so glad. Yeah, I find these how-to books really inspiring as well. And it's surprising to me that even things that were made in the 90s are actually part of history now.
I know. Isn't that weird? I still feel like, I mean, I'm only 32, but when I think back to the 90s, it just doesn't seem very long ago. And I saw somebody post on Facebook the other day that was like, the time between 1960 and 1990 is the same between 1990 and 2020, you know? And it just, I can't, you know, you can only imagine what maybe my parents were thinking about 1990 and how we feel today. But that's totally off track. I apologize for that. Moving forward, we got the Polaroid. We've talked about Candids. We've talked a lot about the history of photography. But now I want to switch gears and see what, having seen the history of photography, and why we kind of choose to design the elements that we did, where do you think photography is going from here?
Man, that's really interesting. I am not good at predicting the future. if 2020 has taught me anything, it's that. but I think, you know, virtual reality is still really exciting. Also augmented reality. So what kinds of objects can we put in our spaces? And how do those images, you know, interact in different ways? Already, you know, with Zoom calls and even like Instagram stories, it feels as if other people are like sharing space with us, even when we're distant today. But I think that photography can, or should, you know, take more of an active role in that space. We need to think about how we project ourselves into the world, even if our interaction with that world is kind of limited in the time of COVID-19.
Wow. Well, that's a very honest look, I suppose, as far as what the future is going to look like for photography. I had just seen a few weeks ago, I interviewed a photographer named Shane Bolkowicz. Do you know who Shane Bolkowicz is?
I don't, sorry.
So, no worries. So he is a photographer in North Dakota who, he started doing wet plate photography again. So he's one of like a few, you know, 100, maybe 1,000 photographers in the world who does like legitimate wet plate photography. And he was telling me all about it and obviously the amount of work that has to go into it. And it was just a really fascinating look. I had somewhere that I was going with that and now I lost it. Again, you know, a lot of it is really interesting to see kind of where we came from in photography because it does give you perspective as far as where we're at today, you know. A lot of these things we don't even question, and kind of being forced to look at the past has been really eye-opening for me, and I think moving forward as well is going to change a lot of things. So I got one last question for you because I know that you've been super gracious with your time. As far as all of the trends that you have seen in photography, right, from how we got to the daguerreotype to here we are today, you know, it being able to instantly take a photo of a major world event and it being seen around the world within minutes, what do you think was one of the biggest advancements that we've made in photography?
I think without a doubt, it's portraits. Just the ability to take a picture of a person and have that image outlast the person is huge. I mean, we can see what people looked like and know that they, you know, they really looked like that. It's, as long as it's not a candid, they really looked like that up until, you know, after 1839, we have access to people that we didn't have access to before. And it's not just that we get, you know, an unvarnished look at them because there's no painter's hand involved, but I think it's also because eventually it's widely accessible and anybody can have their portrait made. So it's not just elite or aristocratic people, but everybody can have a picture. And I think that was the biggest transformation for photography, for me at least.
There was a real concern there in the beginning as well, right? Between people who got their pictures or their portraits painted and those who got photographed, because allegedly people were concerned that they really didn't look good and that a photograph was going to paint them in a pretty negative light. Isn't that right?
Yes. I mean, we all know this, right? Like, not every picture is good. and again, you're defining that good for yourself. But initially it required so much light, and people had real ideas about what a good portrait could be and how to, you know, represent yourself not only accurately, but ideally. So lots of things like how to use shadows effectively, what kind of angle or dress or expression on the face. So it's not just things that photographers had to learn, but also sitters for portraits had to learn how to compose themselves in pictures. I mean, it's not that far removed from my friend who told me how to pose for a selfie.
Just hold the camera up high and just, you know, wide cheeks and then you're good to go. That's it. That's too funny. Tongue on the roof of the mouth. I'm going to have to remember that. I haven't heard that one before. That's good.
I don't think people do that one anymore. That was pretty short-lived.
Okay, well, that would make sense. I feel like that's something, you know, I've heard the smile with the eyes and I've heard the, you know, all those sorts of things, but that one I hadn't. That's new to me, but Kim, again, I want to say thank you for coming on and sharing just your wealth of knowledge when it comes to the world of photography and the history behind it and forcing us to take an honest look at where we're at today so that we can move forward maybe with a little bit more education and a little bit more, I don't know, poise, I guess. So I want to say thank you very much, and I want to invite you to kind of share with the listeners where they can find you online and find your book, Good Pictures, as well.
Yeah, well, thank you, Raymond. This has been a really pleasant conversation. You've really, you've been a great reader of this book, and I appreciate it. And likewise, I'd love to talk to other people who've read the book or who see trends in contemporary photography. You can find me on Instagram at K-E-B-E-I-L. That's K-E-B-E-L. And also my book is available on Amazon.com. The book is called Good Pictures, A History of Popular Photography, and it's published by Stanford University Press. I also have a website. If you need to find me by email, it's kimbeal.com.
We have come a long way, haven't we? This is kind of crazy to think about just the road that photography has taken us on and how it has progressed over time. And I really appreciate Kim for coming on and sharing everything that she did, just specifically about the history of photography. Because when you know kind of where we came from, it's really cool to see where we're at today and even get a glimpse of where we could be going in the future here. But my biggest takeaway from this episode with Kim is just simply, you know, the idea of originality. If something is, you know, not cool, quote unquote, who cares, really? You know, just do it anyway. Like we were saying there in the 50s and 60s, like before that, there was this big push for just technical perfection. But then after that, people started just doing whatever and test things out. And it wasn't until they started testing things out that we really advanced in the world of photography. So, I mean, photography is just weird in the first place, right? With all of its trends and styles, it really does ebb and flow for what is generally accepted as what looks good and what doesn't. Because nobody thinks that our parents' wedding photos look good. Nobody thinks that our own yearbook photos look good. But at the time, like, we loved them. We loved them. But photography has changed. And so what you have to do as a photographer is just do what feels right. Do what feels right in the moment and not worry about the trends or what is cool. Because if you like something, who cares, right? Do you like it? Well, then good. Then do more of that. And that's it. So that is it for this episode of the podcast. And do not forget to do your business a favor and check out the Contract Vault. You will find all of the photography contracts you need right at your fingertips when you head to thecontractvault.com and use promo code BPP for 20% off of your first month. Again, that's promo code BPP for Beginner Photography Podcast and get 20% off your first month. So until next week, I want you to make do. I want you to make more. I want you to do more. And I want you to make do with what you got, because I promise you, it's better than you think. Stay safe.
Thank you for listening to the Beginner Photography Podcast. If you enjoy the show, consider leaving a review in iTunes. Keep shooting, and we'll see you next week.